For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website. Good evening. And welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time here. Good to see you. I'm Aishin Nancy Easton, and I thought I would talk tonight a little bit about right livelihood, which is something that I've been thinking about lately. And you may have heard of this, or you might have heard it called skillful livelihood. It comes from the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a Dhammapada teaching. It comes from actually from Buddha's first Dharma talk. And you remember maybe last month I spoke about the first words that Buddha said upon awakening, which were, you know, how marvelous that all beings are endowed with Buddha nature, or the nature of awakening, which Buddha then expanded upon in his first teaching, which was called the Discourse on Turning the Wheel of the Dharma. Buddha wanted to particularly talk with other ascetics that he had been sitting with and practicing with for a while, and he, in this discourse, expounds on the middle way and the importance of avoiding asceticism and avoiding chasing after sensory pleasures, both of which can kind of erode our well-being. And Buddha then goes on to talk about suffering in the form of the Four Noble Truths, you know, the first noble truth being the existence and pervasiveness of suffering. The second noble truth being the origin of suffering in our craving and grasping, or, you know, just that, the hedonism of chasing after sense pleasures. The possibility, which is the third noble truth, is the possibility of ceasing suffering and restoring well-being. And the fourth noble truth, which is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering, which then he goes on to describe as the Noble Eightfold Path. And while this came out of an orientation or a path towards self-liberation, I think it's important to emphasize that Buddha's teachings were not to escape from the world, but actually to help us relate to the world and ourselves skillfully. It wasn't about, you know, get me out of here. It was about how do we live. So, you know, I think these teachings are especially valuable for those of us, perhaps all of us, who, you know, have to engage with the world and earn a living. And they are sometimes, I think we can think of them in a way that's not so helpful if we think about, you know, this is right livelihood and that's wrong livelihood. I think it's more important to use these teachings as a way to answer the question, you know, how can we use our work as a spiritual practice? It's a little bit of an antidote, I think, to our sometimes tendency to see work as a means to an end and something to avoid whenever possible, something that we, you know, have to go do every day, but really our lives are, you know, after 5 p.m. or on weekends. And it's really more about integrating our work with our life and using our work as an opportunity to wake up and help others around us to wake up. So I wanted to talk for a moment about the Noble Eightfold Path, which I think in Theravada teaching was originally a path to self-liberation, but I think that you can actually You can take a Theravada or Mahayana view about the Eightfold Path. And when I say, you know, Mahayana view, it's maybe thinking about how we can use our practice as a means of helping the world wake up, how breaking down the distinction between self and others, and using all of these practices as a way to help ourselves and others to wake up. So there are eight dimensions. There is, you know, right or maybe skillful understanding or view, which involves a deep understanding of the Four Noble Truths of Suffering. And then there's also number two would be skillful thinking. So then, which might involve reflecting on the way things are, how we create suffering in our lives, something that we can practice and reflect on. And then we have three that kind of come together in terms of a moral discipline. So the first two are more attitudes. That we have skillful speech, which is, you know, speaking truthfully, positively, consistently, not saying one thing to one person or another thing to another person, not exaggerating, finding ways to be helpful with our speech and beneficial. Skillful action, which involves acting with reverence for life, non-harming, not stealing. A lot of the right action is related to our precepts and the things that we are doing in the world. And then there's skillful or right livelihood, which I won't go into more right now. But those three, right speech, right action, right livelihood, are called the Shila or moral discipline of the Eightfold Path. Those three together. We also have skillful effort, which involves intelligent action, knowing when and how to act and or rest. Skillful mindfulness, so remembering to come back to the present moment, remembering to stay with what we are doing, which I think is also very crucial to right livelihood. How do we maintain mindfulness in our work? And then skillful concentration, or cultivating one-pointed mind. So these eight dimensions all work together in our lives as we start to study them and practice them to help co-create an environment of removing suffering from the world and supporting awakening for self and others. So to talk a little bit more about right livelihood, you know, it was originally defined as a way of earning a living without transgressing any of the five mindfulness teachings, which are based on sort of the original five precepts. So it's kind of a list of knots, you know, not dealing in arms or weapons, not dealing in human beings, such as in slavery or prostitution or exploitation, not engaging in the meat trade, not selling alcohol, drugs, or poisons, and not making prophecies or telling fortunes. So not doing all these things, because all of them are surefire ways to lead to suffering. So right livelihood was finding some way to avoid doing these things. But it doesn't tell us a lot about what right livelihood is. And I think that's what we can maybe discuss a little bit. Right livelihood is ideally part of our practice of transforming suffering. It's not just about individual liberation. It's not just a list of good or bad occupations. It's really a practice. It's, you know, it's a way of thinking about our engagement with the world. We know that we can never fully observe the precepts, because that's just not how it works. There is always a way in which, in our concrete, four-dimensional world, we are not able to fully enact our ideals. But right livelihood is similar to the precepts. It's something that we can practice in terms of thinking about how our livelihood affects everyone else around us, but can also impact how we are feeling about ourselves and the world. I will use the example of myself. Many years ago, before I knew any of you, I was a graphic designer. It was kind of right after college, and I was working in advertising, and I found a job where I was working on cigarette and alcohol accounts. And I had kind of a problem with this, but I kind of constantly had to justify it to myself. And I would always say things like, well, you know, advertising must really not work because I don't smoke and I'm around like smoking advertising all day. In fact, I'm creating, you know, cigarette advertising. But you can see that I always felt a little bit bad about this. But at the same time, I felt like I need a job. And I don't know what I'm going to do if I don't have this job. And so there was always a little bit of a conflict. And actually, even before I came to Buddhist practice, I was able to find another job in advertising something a little bit more wholesome, you know, cereal and I forget what else, I guess Lunchables. And even actually around the time I came to practice, I decided to go back to school and something else. But I like to think about that as being, kind of a way that I was, without really knowing it, you know, kind of orienting myself in the world towards, you know, what is it that is important to do? And I won't go into the whole deliberation behind, you know, changing careers. But there was a feeling of, you know, what would be more right? And so we can all engage with that. And I think it's really important that we have compassion for ourselves as we try to find a way of being with our work that we can be at peace with and that reflects our ideals and values. I was reading a really great example by Thich Nhat Hanh in which he talks about a cattle farmer who inherited a multi-generational family farm in which they, you know, raise cattle for slaughter. But this cattle farmer really wanted to practice the precepts, wanted to, you know, practice Buddhism, and was asking, you know, is this okay? Can I do this? And you know, kind of had sort of a similar moral dilemma of, you know, it said, you know, well, I try to give these cattle a good life while they're alive, and we have our own slaughterhouse here on the farm, so we, you know, help them to meet their end without unnecessary cruelty. I need to support my, you know, my family, which consists of many generations. And so this cattle farmer had really a dilemma of being intertangled with the world. You know, we can see that this person's circumstances deeply impact his thoughts and feelings about himself, about his family, his cows, the world. And I think we're all like this. You know, when we first come to practice, when we think about not maybe just our livelihood, but also about how all the other ways in which we engage the people and beings in our world. Are we thinking about, you know, maybe them as things that we do something to, or, you know, are we able to, we come to begin to recognize, you know, that there's maybe each of them are subjects in their own right. And Thich Nhat Hanh talks about how this farmer has inherited very deep thought energy and habit energy from his family, from generations of family. And you know, we just chanted the Song of the Grass Hut, in which we were chanting, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. And I think that that's what that line refers to, the ways in which our generations of family orient ourselves to thinking about the world in a particular way. And how challenging it can be to, you know, break away from that, that our families teach us really from our first days, you know, what the world is, how you relate to it, how you relate to work. You know, you may have family who that tells you, you know, you should do this for a living. You don't want to be a forest ranger. You want to make money and go into, you know, plastics. Or we can hold up. I know it's.
It was a graduate reference.
I think I had ideas, you know, when I was coming out of college of, you know, this thing would be very glamorous to do. And it's funny because our culture in particular, I think, really rewards, you know, like the superstars. We reward athletes and entertainers, and we don't really reward as well the people who are, you know, cleaning our streets and teaching our children and keeping us safe. We don't reward the people in these occupations monetarily or with a lot of status, and yet they're often doing some of the most important work, some of the work that we might consider the most, you know, right livelihood. But anyway, so this farmer, this cattle farmer, you know, has inherited this orientation of what, I mean, inherited more than a farm, has inherited a whole orientation of how you make your life, and has really no idea what else he could possibly do, you know, so how can he practice Buddhism and still do this? And so what Thich Nhat Hanh recommends is that the person start to practice mindfulness and meditation and allow a proper way out of this situation of killing to present itself, you know, and I think that's a nice reminder, is that we don't do any kind of practice all by ourselves. We turn ourselves toward it, and then it starts to meet us. And as we, you know, as we meet it a little bit more, it comes and meets us a little bit more. So, you know, but I think it starts with that thought of what am I doing and why. And for me, I don't, you know, had I not had a moment of thinking, okay, I'm not really sure I feel okay about advertising cigarettes and alcohol, I wouldn't have, you know, pragmatically speaking, I wouldn't have ever had the maybe need to try to find a different job or you know, let alone a different line of work. So the precepts are helping us practice them, and right livelihood is helping us to practice it as well as we begin to orient ourselves toward it. And similar to any path we walk down, as we start to, you know, walk that path, we discover more options and more different ways of thinking about this. So, you know, we never really succeed 100% at right livelihood because of all of these different interconnections in our lives. But can we move in more of a direction of increasing our compassion and reducing suffering for ourselves and others? Which I think takes me to maybe the last thing I want to say about this, which is how we behave at whatever job we have is actually very much related to right livelihood and related to the whole rest of the Eightfold Path. We, as we start to think about, you know, our livelihood, we start to bring things like right view or right thinking or right action, maybe right mindfulness to our work. So in thinking about maybe the just random things that happen to us during the day, you know, as we maybe answer the phone, can we do this in a way where we are, you know, using the phone as an opportunity, you know, the ringing of the phone as an opportunity to say, okay, you know, wake up, where am I? Can I come back to this present moment? Can we answer the phone mindfully with awareness of the impact of our tone of voice maybe on the person on the other end? You know, you pick up the phone, you go, hello. It's going to have a totally different effect on the person at the other end of it, as compared to if you said, you know, hello, how are you? Where I work, we have people who come in every year, and they work with us as part of their training, and they're in a very vulnerable place. They're learning something. They're not very confident. They're not employees. They're there on a voluntary basis, and they're there to learn something as part of their training. And it's especially kind. It's especially important, to be kind to them, because they are feeling so, you know, new and lost. And I've learned over time what an impact, you know, every sort of gesture or statement can have sometimes, far beyond what we intend or what we think is reasonable or what we think even that they're the reaction that they're having. So how do we then, you know, practice maybe right speech with our colleagues, right mindfulness, right effort? Can we bring skillful effort to, you know, all of our activities, knowing when it's appropriate to act, when it's appropriate to rest? And so, you know, we can work our work in ways that help us to stay mindful and awake, and ways that encourage the people around us to be peaceful and happy. That will often, you know, increase our ability to be productive, but it will also help to, you know, reduce our own suffering and the suffering of people around us. And that really is, I think, practicing right livelihood in whatever occupation it is that we might have right now. So I think that's really all I want to say. This was supposed to be my Labor Day talk, but I guess I'm a week late. somebody else got Labor Day this year, so... But if anybody has any thoughts or questions or anything you'd like to share about right livelihood or really anything else, we have a few minutes. Matt. Yeah.
What I also see the opposite happening, where some people's work life never ends because they're constantly, like, you know, including me sometimes, you know, like emails or connected. And there's almost this expectation now that we're always working.
Yeah.
So how do we like figure out the balance with that, like bringing our whole selves to work without making it the only thing?
Yeah. That sounds like right effort to me. that work starts to take up, you know, so much effort that we're out of balance. I don't know if you're looking for ideas on how to stop.
It's like another, it's just interesting. I see, like, with my friends, and I'm just like, it's more like just everyone's always on call almost.
Yeah. I remember when I was a freelancer, back when I was still a graphic designer, and I got a pager, and I was very excited about my pager because it made me feel very important that people, you know, might need to call me at various hours. And, you know, it can be the same thing with a cell phone. I think that's really something that we can look at. I don't want to say that we have to look at, but I think it's something that if we are trying to, you know, practice with these ideals, that it's something that we could look at and think about, you know, what is motivating me to feel like I need to be available all the time? And, you know, I don't know that there's a right or a wrong. It's maybe something that we could think about. You know, what is the impact of that practice of being constantly available to work? What is the impact of that on my family or on my partner? What is it? What is the impact of that on my health? Are there some things that I do think it's worth being available for, or, you know, where do I draw the line? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I mean, it's easy to get into that, but I think there are a lot of studies that show that people who work more are actually more productive, actually less productive than people who live in Norway or places like that, where they have like no email after a certain time or something like that. That they actually get more done, and it's just kind of interesting that you know. And I think some of it is like avoiding. But also some of it is like this feeling like you want to, for me anyway, that's like a little bit of what I like, I want to do a good job.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know, I think that idea of right effort though might be good too. Like, maybe sometimes right effort means resting, you know, or taking a nap or something.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe thinking about, you know, how much is this contributing to my well-being, or how much is it actually contributing to my own suffering? How much of it is then creating a culture in my company where everybody feels like they have to be constantly available? How many employees leave because they don't want to do that?
So I've been retired for 5.5 years, and I'm sitting here thinking about what is really lively for people who are a retired person. And actually, it's still pretty relevant, because I do have things that still seem like work, and still things that seem like play. I'm not sure those are the exact categories. But it's sort of like me. It means more of taking responsibility for not wasting your time, you know, to be creative, productive, happy, thriving in some way that's positive, making a positive effort, whether it's livelihood or not.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
To think of it. It's not attached to a job or
I'm just curious if you don't mind sharing what you consider work in retirement relative to play. Like, what feels like it makes the distinction for you?
So, work is an odd word for it, but I mean, there are things that I think I should go to yoga 5 times a week. There's things that are sort of my responsibility.
Okay, like an obligation.
Yeah.
Work is the obligation, or?
I've made a commitment that's part of what I would do rather than, I don't know. It's not exactly lying.
Yeah.
But you could, I mean, I've had lots of people tell me when they retired, they had no idea how to feel good about spending their time. So you do have to think. I mean, right, livelihood is a helpful way to frame it. And one of the things, Dale, who's one of our practitioners, who was an emergency room physician for many years, he's retired, and I asked him, why did he choose emergency medicine, as his field of medicine? And he says, because if he had been a different kind of doctor, he would not be able to stop at the end of the day. He would work 24 hours a day because he would have in his head his patients who, but in the emergency room, they either die or you fix them or they go off to someone else. But it was a way he were a little managed and not.
Interesting. Yeah, because you turn over your shift at the end of the shift, and whoever's still there goes to the person who's working next. Dennis.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was sitting and thinking, I retired 14 years ago. Yeah. Although I still work part-time.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, I have I'm a teacher, I teach one course a semester. Right. You know, summers are quite a difficult time for me because I don't know. I was sitting there thinking, I wish I had any likelihood of that. You know, I'm always kind of, I don't know, maybe you are too, but I'm always on the lookout for an opportunity to do something. I'm like, volunteer for this and volunteer
right.
for that. And, last year it was about once a week meeting with an Iraqi refugee in Turin. You know, any other thing like that that comes up would be part of it. But, you know, I guess the only thing I want to say is that we really need livelihood at all times of life. You know, I think I still do.
Yeah.
How do you know? You know, if you have a sense of yourself as doing something worthwhile and creating value for others, you can't get that from amusements.
It's such a shame that our culture, I think this is maybe changing, or it's maybe changing within, you know, sort of the middle or upper middle class, but I think our culture can really devalue volunteer jobs. And I think that's such a shame because they're some of the coolest things you could do and some of the most essential. we'll talk afterwards. Is your name Ben?
Yes.
Hi. Welcome.
What happened to the Catholic Church?
I don't know, because that was the end of the story. the recommendation was, if you want to practice, just come practice and see if the way to leave behind this livelihood of killing, you know, occurs to you. So I don't know. What do you think happens to the cattle rancher?
I don't know. I'm in the same position. I'm not a cattle rancher. But I'm not a vegan either.
Yeah.
And I just think a lot about this, about every article recently about formerly vegan and vegetarian chefs who were vegan and vegetarian and environmental or ethical grounds and various grounds. And then but I think about it, that's a very conscious practice that they went through to come to that decision. But it doesn't look like what the precepts say.
Yeah. That's always a really complicated and thorny issue whenever we talk about the... Excuse me, this is not supposed to be happening. Okay. Whenever we talk about the first grave precept of not killing, I'm also not a vegan, and I find that it's just not a good way for me to try to go for a bunch of different reasons. And... you know, that's complicated, and I think that's part of why we can't 100% ever fully keep the precepts in any of them, because our lives are so complex and so intertwined, and we're always a little bit, you know, in the mess of the world. We try to do what we can for the good, and we try to minimize the bad that we do. But I don't know. You know, I think we just have to have compassion for ourselves and continue to work with that thorny issue, even as we are living. You know, our immune systems are killing off, you know, all the things that want to kill us off. So even if we stopped eating anything, I mean, the whole cycle goes on. So I think it's maybe important to, you know, think about, just find different ways to think about that whole cycle. And you know, how we contribute to the life cycle. But yeah, it's I know that there are people within our Sangha for whom veganism makes the most sense, and there are people who aren't.
I've had a similar, I had a thought and a question, but there's a similar example I've seen with some examples of indigenous culture where there's, you know, folks who have relationships, like cultures that have relationships with deer or buffalo, for example, that is not vegan, is not vegetarian, but is you know, in terms of how it syncs with the cycle of how nature continues and what they do with that animal and how many different ways it's used as part of their livelihood, feels to me like a very different kind of relationship than like factory farming, you know, consumptive relationship with an animal. There's sort of like an understanding of the sacrifice and the balance that's happening when with that kind of relationship. I'm not of that culture, but you know, I've noticed in documentaries like what some of those practices were and had a similar recognition that I think what's going on there is different than what us as a, you know, in capitalism and the United States kind of view as a relationship of getting your meat from a, you know, from the grocery store looks like. I had just a question that doesn't have to do with livelihood, that's just been on my mind, if I can ask.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Does practice like uncover, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. So I've been practicing for a couple of years now, and I have friends who, you know that I practice, and I can't tell if I'm becoming more of the self that I already was, or if there are, like, if folks are starting to, like, project a sense of, like, ooh, ah, onto me or something, and where I'm actually being obscured because I'm practicing, you know, and that there's sort of a projection that I know what's going, like, you know, that I would know what's going on, or I'm more in tune than somebody else or something because I'm doing this on a regular basis, because mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. want that to be the case, mm-hmm. and I don't want to be, having relationships that aren't authentic with people. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but it's just what's on my mind right now, that I can't tell, like, am I just being more myself? Am I communicating myself more authentically now in a way that I wasn't able to before practicing? Or is that me attempting to do that being misconstrued as like trying to be, you know, like a holier than thou? Does that make sense?
Is that how people are perceiving it?
I don't know. I just get like comments sometimes like, oh, you seem really, you know, hooked in or something, you know, as if like everybody else isn't also, you know what I mean? So I don't know how to manage that.
I don't know. I wonder if it depends on the person, your particular relationship with each person. Maybe some of your friends know you better than others, and I don't know what maybe their motive is in saying something about it.
Okay. That's fine.
I'm always a little suspicious when people comment on, you know, how I seem to be coming across.
I know.
Too. Yeah.
I'll talk to you later.
Other questions or? Yeah.
I just want to raise another issue that we can't talk about. There's something to think about. The part where I got into it is our use of money. And I've been really weird thinking a lot about that. Like, I got a small inheritance, and I don't know how much should I keep for myself? What should I give? You know? I think that comes up for all of us too. But, you
know, yeah.
In my early days, I was not a problem.
Yeah, that's. I hadn't really thought about that dimension of it too. Of, you know, what? Where do we put the resources that we have? What do we do with that? What do we support? I know there are lots of debates about, you know, socially responsible mutual funds or you know, investments or things like that that I can't really comment on. But that's a good dimension. Yeah. I think that and you know, volunteering and what we do when we're not at work are all ways of informing our thoughts about right livelihood. Really, I think right livelihood is, you know, expanded is more just more about how we are engaging with the world, how we're engaging with the world as we try to go about supporting ourselves. It's for sure it's not a completely altruistic thing, because we have needs that we need to meet by our engagement with the world, but we're also trying to do something wholesome for, you know, self and others at the same time with the world. So thank you for a good conversation.